At the dawn of the Viking Age, the family farm was the basic economic unit of Norse life. As farmers and herdsmen, they planted grains and vegetables during the short growing seasons and relied heavily on livestock. But peace in the Northland was coming to an end. The expanding Viking population needed more fertile farmland, and tensions boiled over. Inevitably, violence flared between the Viking clans. As the stronger attacked the weaker, raiders fell on farmers with axes, swords, and brutal violence. Land feuds erupted with utter lawlessness.
Basically, a king was a man who had a big farm. And he had his bonders, his farmers, and his slaves. And whenever he felt like going and attacking somebody else, he just got all his guys together and went off and attacked them. The Vikings would run into the village, grab everything they could, take off again. It's not terribly sophisticated, but very effective.
Some Vikings, however, set aside their differences and prepared to seek their fortunes elsewhere. The hands and tools that once shaped the cross beams of barns turned to another task. Along the shores of the northern inlets, boats were built. Boats that changed the lives of these people. Viking longships. These extraordinary vessels, revolutionary in design, took history on a new course and launched an onslaught that dominated Europe and beyond for the next three centuries.
Well, that's part of the story of the Vikings. Yeah. And this is Thor's Day. I like the sound of it. I like Wotan's Day, too. That's yesterday. Yeah. And Freya's Day coming up tomorrow. That's in honor of the Nordic women. Most of the guys who talk about the Vikings, and I've seen all the young guys, they always got them with their warriors and they got their battle axes and all that kind of stuff. But that's not the way they started, because most people are simply tribalist. And they like to get along in a tribe and hunt together and so forth and farm together and like that. And they really don't want trouble. But invariably, there's always a couple of assholes in the countryside that want it all. Like this recording said, the big farmer turned out to be the king. And then he just went out and took what he wanted, which caused a lot of problems for other people. So anyhow, the lands they lived in were not greatly productive farmlands. A lot of rocky territory and not many forests to hunt in and like that. So as they outbred their land and had more and more children and so forth, they needed more and more food, and so they were getting tired of warring against each other, finally, white people. So they decided, well, let's go kick the ass of other people. I mean, way off, not right here at home. We've kicked each other's asses long enough. But they still did that too, I guess. So they built their longships, and away they went to invade England and other countries. And they went all the way down into the Mediterranean and places like that. So for a long time, maybe couple hundred years, maybe 300 years, they were the guys who scared everybody. The Vikings are coming. I like to read the cartoon in the paper. We got Hagar the Viking. He's funny. And he's probably typical of a lot of the way the Vikings were. You know, he has a wife doing all the work. He wants to sit around and drink with the boys. Yeah. Anyhow, that's the way the Vikings got going, and they're still digging up some of their boats out of the bottom of the ocean and the bays around the place. And I guess maybe we may have to revert back to that one of these days too. If this system really does collapse, then it'll be go for it, baby. Hey, white guy, and there are no cops around now. The cops all took off because they didn't get paid. They don't have any food. So they're out trying to scrape up food just like you are. Yeah. So now you got the feel to yourself, and if you want to kick the ass of the people you always wanted to kick the ass of, primarily your third world people, well, that's the way it goes. Might makes right. Those days are coming again. Don't get all upset and don't get all, well, it's never going to be any fun anymore. Well, it may not be you, but your kids probably, or maybe your grandkids. We'll get this thing going again. Hey, this is Terrible Tommy, and it is the 8th month, the 4th day, 2016. We're off and running. Of course, this is August, named after the Augustus of Rome. I like the way all of our months and days are dedicated to white leaders and warriors and so forth. I like that. They haven't changed that yet. They'll try. You know, they'll try to get Mohammed X in there January. Let's see, what, Tuesday? Tuesday will be Michelle Obama Tuesday. All that shit. Well, I sent you out a little bulletin, a little thing yesterday. I don't know whether I should have sent it or not. But I get these feelings about things. You know what I mean? Sort of like extra sensory perception. Maybe not that finely done, not that professional, but I get feelings about things that are going on right at the present time. And the way Trump is acting, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, even if he were going to throw this thing, he would do it a little different way. He's acting too strange. And my perception says he may have a serious psychological problem. Now, I know the other side says, he's crazy, he's nuts. I don't mean like that. I mean, he may be sick. And he may have a tumor. Of course, that's just my speculation. But he's in a perfect position to carried out some things and made himself look good and so forth. And he seems like he's doing everything he can to do the opposite. And he's not doing it cool, which tends to make me believe there's something wrong in his noggin. Anyhow, that's my opinion, and I'm going to stick to it for a while. No matter what happens, it may take years for it to develop full-blown to where he's institutionalized or whatever. I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy, but it looks that way to me. Of course, the very fact that he's spreading chaos and the chaos factor is all right with me, because nothing's more friendly to our cause than chaos. You see, we're some guy in the middle of London town up there yesterday, knifed several people, killed one or two. One of them was an American. Wow. Get the army out now, boy. They killed an American. You know what most of these Americans are? They come over from the third world and Africa and all that, and they get a citizenship in the United States, and then they go traveling. And usually they're causing trouble, like these ones, the missionaries that went to North Korea. They start spreading their bullshit and hoing, yong, boing. He said, no, not here, you're going to prison. And I don't blame him. They've got their religion, whatever it is, and if that's what they want, that's what they should keep, and other people should stay away. But anyhow, these people come here, get a citizenship, and then they've got some mission on their mind, some crazy mission. and off they go to these other countries, and then they get jailed, and then all you hear on the media, you don't hear Nigger Jones got thrown in jail in North Korea, or Gook guy got thrown in jail in some country. No, you don't hear that. They say the American got thrown in jail, leading you to believe that the person might be white, and then they say, oh, it's horrible. We got to send the army. We got to send the navy. And now what? We had 5 or 6 guys got thrown in jail for spying over there in Iran, and they probably were. I don't have any proof one way or the other, but a lot of times when they're accused of spying, they were spying. And so Obama sends them $400 million in a plane. Remember, we did that in Iraq, too. Millions of dollars that were loaded up down in New York City on the docks and sent to Iraq. Hundreds and hundreds of pounds of $100 bills. And one of the CIA guys laughed about it, that they were using bundles of money for footballs and kicking them around in a sand lot over there in Iraq. Yeah. Oh boy, man, we got a wonderful government. Let me take that back. We don't have a government. We just got a bunch of crooks. You know, like even Al Capone had it more together than these people. Al Capone was a crook, but he was fairly sharp in the way he handled things too. You don't think that he would have sent $1 million in cash over to his competitor, do you? Like Legs Diamond or one of those guys? No, he'd have sent his best torpedoes over there and wiped them out. But most of the time, a lot of the times, these people that are over there and getting these situations, they deserve it because they're doing something that was off the wall. They disobeyed the laws of another country. I have no sympathy for those people that do things in other countries that are against the law. I've been around the world, not totally around the world, but two-thirds way around the world, and I always observed the laws of the country. I never had any problem. Oh, one time I was riding a bike. I was 18 in the Army. I was in Amsterdam. And I was riding a bicycle, half sloshed, been drinking with the boys, riding this bicycle as fast as I could down this narrow street in Amsterdam. All of a sudden, a big arm and a big hand reached out and grabbed me by the arm and spun me around and almost fell off the bicycle. And he just took his finger and waved it back and forth. No, no, you don't do that here. And he made me a believer. From then on, I obey the law. Now, back to this Trump thing. Now, you probably know by now that I pick up a lot of articles that are not from the right-wing conservative racial groups. And some of them are our enemies, and some of them are sort of our enemies, and some of them are all our enemies, and some of them are sort of our friends. And you got to take them where you see them and sort it out. So here's an article that came in today about Donald Trump. Now, this guy is not for Donald Trump, but he's also not for the people that are going wacko attacking Donald Trump. Let's see what he says. The widespread disdain for Donald Trump and the fear of what his presidency might mean have led to abandonment of any sense of objectivity by many Trump opponents, and most notably, mainstream U.S. news media. To which I say, that's no accident. It was planned this way from the beginning. If Trump is for something, it must be bad. It must be transformed into one more club to use for hobbling his candidacy. While that attitude may be understandable, given Trump's frequent, feckless, and often offensive behavior, he seems not to know the basic facts and insults large swaths of the world's population. Yeah, I think you could lay off of that a little bit too myself. Even if you hate somebody, why not sneak up on them? Why tell them right to their face right away? Get into power before you make a move. This Trump bashing also has dangerous implications because some of his ideas deserve serious debate rather than blanket dismissal. Okay. Amid his incoherence and insults, Trump has raised valid points on several important questions, such as the risks involved in the vociferous expansion of NATO, which I say dump NATO, get rid of it, don't make any sense anymore, unless you're the military-industrial arms builder. Up to the Russian, they want it right up to the Russian borders and like give Putin the finger. And the wisdom of demonizing Russia and its internally popular President Vladimir Putin. Over the past several years, Washington's neo-dominated foreign policy establishment has pushed a stunning policy of destabilizing nuclear-armed Russia in the pursuit of a regime change in Moscow. This is like playing with fire. This existential risky strategy has taken shape with the minimal substantive debate behind a groupthink driven by anti-Russian and anti-Putin propaganda. Those warlords in Washington just always have to have a new or even an old and renewed enemy. Always drumming up enemies. Never drumming up peace. That's me talking. All we hear is what's wrong with Putin and Russia. I watch Russian news, watch Russia TV. He seems very popular to me. He doesn't sound like a warmonger at all when he talks. But the ones here in our media and people in Washington always sound like war hawks when they talk. He doesn't wear a shirt. He's the new Hitler. Putin and Trump have a bromance. Russian aggression, their athletes cheat. Are you telling me that American athletes don't cheat? Much has happened in the run-up to the disastrous Iraq war. Criminal, Tommy says, by the warmongers in this country. 2002 to 2003, the neocons, the war hawks, and their liberal interventionist allies bully from the public square anyone who doesn't share these views. Any effort to put Russia's behavior in context makes you a Putin apologist, just like questioning the Iraq WMD, certainly of last decade, made you a Saddam apologist. If you didn't say you hated Saddam, you were a treasonous bastard. Let's see, that we've got, 10,000 GIs been killed in stupid Iraq and Afghanistan? I know 5,000 have been killed in Afghanistan. But this new mindlessness, now justified in part to block Trump's path to the White House, could very well set the stage for a catastrophic escalation of the big power tensions under a Hillary Clinton presidency. Tommy says she is a real war bitch. Not just a war hawk, she's a war bitch. Former Secretary of State Clinton has already surrounded herself with neocons and liberal hawks who favor expanding the war against Syria's government, want to ratchet up tensions with Iran, and favor shipping arms to right-wing and virulently anti-Russian regime in Ukraine, which came to power in 2014 coup supported by U.S. policymakers and money. And you know, there's a lot of guys from Europe went over there to fight on the side of the Ukraine against the Russians. A lot of them called themselves National Socialists. They better do their homework. They didn't know what the hell they're talking about. And if they get their ass shot off, I don't have any sympathy for them. A lot of the right-wing groups in this country think, oh, they're wonderful. They went over there to fight Russia. Huh. there's more National Socialists in Russia than there'll ever be in the Ukraine. By lumping Trump's few reasonable points together with his nonsensical comments and making anti-Russian propaganda the only basis for any public debate, Democrats and the anti-Trump press are pushing the United States towards a conflict with Russia. They didn't get it last time. They tried hard. Everybody made lots of money, but they didn't get their atomic war with Russia. And for a U.S. press corps that prides itself on its objectivity, this blatantly biased approach towards a nominee of a major political party is remarkably unprofessional. But the principle of objectivity has been long since abandoned as the mainstream U.S. media transformed itself into little more than an outlet for U.S. government foreign policy narratives, no matter how dishonest or implausible. In short, the United States media is nothing but a filthy whore for the big corporations or the big money people or who's benefiting by it. To conform with the neocon-driven narratives, much recent history has been lost. For instance, few Americans realize that some of President Barack Obama's most notable foreign policy achievements resulted from cooperation with Putin and Russia, arguably more so than any other friendly leader or allied nation. In other words, Putin wants to be friends with the United States. For instance, in summer of 2013, Obama was under intense neocon liberal hawk pressure to bomb Syrian military, supposedly for crossing his red line against the use of chemical weapons after a mysterious sarin gas that was never tied to the Syrian president attack outside Damascus on August 21st, 2103. And I would imagine that was a CIA setup. I mean, they'll do anything, those guys. Yet hearing doubts from the U.S. intelligence community about the Assad regime's guilt, Obama balked at a military strike that we now know would have played into the hands of Syrian jihadists, who some intelligence analysts believe were the ones behind the false flag sarin attack to trick the United States into directly intervening in the civil war on their side. Well, I think also Obama blinked. Obama saw that the Russians were going to jump into it, and he said, well, maybe we ought to rethink this. But Obama still needed a path out of the corner that he had painted himself into, and it was provided by Putin and Russia's pressuring Assad to surrender all his chemical weapons. A clear victory for Obama, regardless of who was behind the sarin attack. Obama backs down pretty easy. That's like every time I've had anything close to a fight with a black guy in the street. They either run, or all they do is flap their gums or something. I remember one riot in Oceanside, California, where we were in the center of a big field and my troops had surrounded me and I was giving a speech, and there was only a couple of black guys in the crowd of people who were against us, and they had boxing gloves up on their hands and they were flopping them around in our face and saying, you know, giving us all this stuff and let's fight and all this shit. Well, all of a sudden a riot broke out from other people, Mexicans and white people, that attacked us. Those black guys were long gone. They were gone in 5 seconds. Putin and Russia helped Obama again in convincing Iran to accept tight restraints on its nuclear program. But they never asked for restraints on Israel's nuclear program, of course. An agreement that may mark Obama's most significant foreign policy success. Well, I think it is a good idea, hopefully, that there's not more nukes around. Those negotiations came to life in 2013, not coincidentally, after Secretary of State Clinton, who allied herself more with the bomb Iran faction led by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, had resigned and was replaced by John Kerry. Kerry's a funny guy. As the negotiating process evolved, Russia played a key role in bringing Iran along, offering ways for Iran to rid itself of its processed nuclear stockpiles and get the medical research materials it needed. Without the assistance of Putin and his foreign minister Sergei Lavrov, the landmark Iranian nuclear deal might never have taken place. But all the war hawks over here, you hear them yapping about how terrible a deal we made with Iran. All the hawks, boy, these chicken hawks, bunch of candy ass. If you ever met them on the street and yelled boo, they'd run like hell into the lap of some cop or something. These guys in Washington are filthy cowards. There isn't 1 in 100 of these people in Washington that would ever fight you to a draw with a fist or a club or even a gun. Obama recognized the value of this Russian help, but he also understood the political price that he would pay if he were closely associated with Putin, who was already undergoing a thorough demonization in the U.S. and European mainstream media. So Obama mostly worked with Putin under the table while joining in the ostracism of Putin above the table. Another cowardly mulatto act. But Washington's neocon-dominated foreign policy establishment and its allied mainstream media checkmated Obama's double-talking game in 2013 by aggressively supporting a regime change strategy in Ukraine, where the pro-Russian elect President Viktor Yanukovych was under mounting pressure from Western Ukrainians who wanted closer ties to Europe and who hated Russia. A lot of you people don't know that Ukraine was one of the places where they used to shove all the Jews into. In ancient times, hundreds of years ago, the Russians used to shove all the Jews out in the Ukraine, almost like a concentration camp. So there's got to be a lot of Jew blood in the Ukraine. Leading neocon thinkers unveiled their new Ukraine strategy shortly after Putin helped scuttle their dreams for a major bombing campaign against Assad's regime in Syria. They just love to drop those bombs, don't they? And then cry because all those people are coming up into Europe. They got no houses, they got nothing. I mean, you know, I don't want them in Europe, but let's call a spade, who caused it? Since the 1990s, the neocons had targeted the Assad dynasty, along with the Saddam Hussein's government in Iraq and Shiite-controlled government in Iran for regime change. Yeah, and that's what Hillary wanted, too. Yeah, she was just thrilled to death to kill Muammar Gaddafi. And Gaddafi ran a pretty tight ship over there. I read a lot of his stuff. I read his little green book and so forth. As those type of people, leaders go, it was pretty good. You know, there were more educated females in his country than any place else in the Middle East except Israel. Women had all pretty much equal rights in Libya and everything. But he made the mistake of going to start his own finance program and develop the gold dinar, I believe is what it was called, and get off of the Wall Street merry-go-round. And that sealed his doom, at least partway. The neocons got their way in Iraq in 2003, but their program stalled because of the disastrous Iraq War. And I hope to still live for the day when people like Bush and Cheney and all his cohorts are tried in The Hague or tried right here. And personally, I prefer they be hung by the neck until dead because of all the people they caused to die and all the American soldiers they caused to die for nothing. But at least put them in prison for the rest of their miserable lives. Every time that Bush comes on TV, I want to get sick at my stomach that he's still walking around and not in jail. However, in 2013, the neocons saw their path forward open again in Syria, especially after the Sirin attack, which killed hundreds of civilians and was blamed on Assad in a media-driven rush to judgment. Which makes me think even more it was a CIA operation. Obama's hesitancy to strike and then Putin's assistance in giving Obama a way out left the neocons furious. All these neocons should be rounded up, put in a concentration camp, put on bread and water. And if they gave anybody any trouble in the camp, just put a bullet in their head. That's the way I feel about it, Mr. FBI and all that bullshit. Began to recognize the need to remove Putin if they were to succeed with their Mideast regime change. In late September 2013, a month after Obama ditched the plans to bomb Syria, neocon National Endowment for Democracy President Carl Gershman, sounds like another Jew, wrote in the Washington Post that Ukraine was now the biggest prize, but also was a stepping stone towards an even bigger regime change prize in Moscow. Gershman, whose NED is funded by Congress, wrote, quote, Ukraine's choice to join Europe will accelerate the demise of the ideology of the Russian imperialism that Putin represents. Russians, too, face a choice, and Putin may find himself on the losing end, not just in the near abroad, but within Russia itself. You know, I'm sure they're doing everything they can to cause trouble inside Russia. I'm telling you, boys, you screw with the Russians, it's a whole new ball game. If Hitler was still around, he could tell you all about it. By late 2013 and early 2014, with Gershman's NED financing Ukraine's anti-government activities, and journalists with an open encouragement of neocon Assistant Secretary of State of European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, there's another bitch that should be tried and hung, and Senator John McCain, and there is a so-called war hero, bullshit, Trump's right about McCain. He's a filthy criminal. He married into a family of the gal was a daughter of the guy that controlled all the liquor beer business down in Arizona. He was also involved in the scandal on the West Coast. I can't remember the name of it. But he was involved in, they had to pull all stops to keep him out of jail. And he was, of course, involved in the Iran-Contra, in the Contra deal in Central America, where thousands of people were killed and murdered. And also the transportation of all the drugs up here to the United States and putting them into the mainly black ghettos for the black people. That's your John McCain, another son of a bitch. With neo-Nazi and other Ukrainian ultra-nationalists firebombing police, the political crisis in Kiev deepened. I ran into CIA-controlled neo-Nazis or National Socialists before. They will use these right-wing neo-Nazis a lot of times for very bad purposes. I remember years ago, and I've told you this before, that we were working with elements in Africa to develop some oil to finance our operations. Yeah, we did. We had something pretty nice going until these asshole CIA phony Hollywood neo-Nazis got involved. And as we were working with these people, black separatists and so forth, the CIA outfitted a ship down in, I believe it was Colombia, and put these two or three neo-Nazis, who I knew one of them, and he definitely had worked for the government as an informant all the time. And they were going to go over to Liberia and overthrow the president of Liberia. Well, the president of Liberia found out about it, and they griped to the Colombian government, and the Colombian government seized the ship with all its weapons and everything that these play Nazis were going to take over there. And that screwed up our whole deal with the oil. So we had our deal going, and the right-wing asshole Hollywood Nazis had their CIA thing going. That deserves a whole show on that. I'll have to dig out some of the information. And this one that was seized down there, they were put into jail down in Colombia, two of them, these Hollywood Nazis. And all of a sudden, one night their door was unlocked on their cell and they were able to escape. A few years later, I ran into the same guy up in the Northwest when we were trying to have a skinhead concert. And he volunteered to be a security guard. There was a long road that went up from the highway to where we were at. So they put him on guard, taking a chance. We weren't quite sure all the bad stuff about him, but we found out. So when the feds came up in their car up the road, he stopped them. Instead of just stopping them and them telling him to get out of the way or whatever, he smashed their window on their car, which was totally uncalled for. And so then they arrested him and took him away. Well, they took him away to debrief him. If you're ever in something like that, and I've been in deals like that more than once, if one of your guys gets stopped and questioned real hard and he comes back, oh, they stopped me and questioned me, he's an informant. They debrief a guy. They debrief him. And this guy was taken away and debriefed. And he was nothing but a filthy, Fed-loving, phony. Well, not phony. He was a Hollywood Nazi. That's what Hollywood Nazis do. If you're still running around with those guys, and there's one outfit now that claims to be pretty big, it's phony as hell, and the guy that leads it is phony as hell, too. And you'll find out one of these days when the shit hits the fan, that leader's going to be hauled off to prison or something's going to happen. Anyhow, meanwhile, Putin was focused on the Sochi Winter Olympics, and the threat of the games could be disrupted by terrorism. And who better to start terrorism but the CIA? So with the Kremlin distracted, Ukraine's Yanukovych tried to fend off his political crisis while limiting the violence. And of course, you were here told on the news what a rat Yanukovych was, a horrible guy. Well, he might not have been perfect, but he was a lot better than the people that were screwing him. However, on February 20th, 2014, snipers fired on both police and protesters in the Maidan Square, and the Western media jumped to the conclusion that Yanukovych was responsible. Right. Even though later investigations have indicated that the sniper attack was more likely carried out by, guess what, Hollywood Nazi groups to provoke the chaos that followed. So if you're in this Hollywood Nazi thing, I want you to understand something. You're most likely working directly or on the periphery with the CIA people and FBI. And whenever they need something violent to go on, they'll call on you. And if you're lucky, you might survive. And if you're not lucky, you go to prison for a long time and not even know what you did. I mean, not even know you were serving the interests of the feds, like in Oklahoma City. There were two plans going on there. One so-called legitimate plan by the right-wingers, and the illegitimate plan by the federal government and Clinton, who needed that type of terrorism, that type of blow-up to serve their purpose, to tighten the control from government. And so they let them plan it and let them carry it out on a smaller scale, and then, but at the same time they planted big dynamite and all that kind of stuff in the building. So they do that all the time. They talk some guy into doing something violent. They give him just enough stuff to be evidence in a court trial. And then he plants the stuff, and then they blow the CIA and those guys plant the big stuff. And so this little guy that was planting firecrackers ends up being charged with planting tons of C4. It's the way they operate, boys. If you fall for it, it's your own. I've told you for years how it works. So if you fall for it, it's your own trouble. That's what happened to Mahon. And I'd preached to him for years, they're going to get you. If you don't watch out, they're going to get you. And sure as hell, they set him up. Nothing you can do for people like that except send him a kind letter, a card, and a box of candy. Same way with Matt Hale. The U.S. State Department and its Western allies quickly recognized the coup regime as the legitimate government of the Ukraine, friendly to the big banks, the capitalist West. But the coup provoked resistance from the ethnic Russian population in Crimea and eastern Ukraine. Political uprisings that the new Kiev regime denounced as terrorists encountered with an anti-terrorism operation, or what they called ATO. When the Russian troops already in Crimea as part of the Sevastopol naval basing agreement protected the people of the peninsula from attacks by the Ukrainian ultranationalists and Hollywood Nazis, the intervention was denounced in the West as a Russian invasion. Crimean authorities also organized a referendum in which more than 80% of the voters participated and favored leaving Ukraine and rejoining Russia by a 96% margin. I call that democracy. Washington calls it Putin dictatorship. When Moscow agreed, that became Russian aggression, according to Washington and our little nigger in Washington and all his Republican friends, which he claims he hates their guts, but that's not all it's cracked up to be. Although the Kremlin refused appeals from eastern Ukraine for a similar arrangement, Russia provided some assistance to the rebels resisting the new authorities in Ukraine. Those rebels then declared their own autonomous republic. And those people were more national socialists than any of these national socialists that went down there from England and Germany and all that bullshit, and even the United States. And like I say, they made a movie about it, a documentary, which I watched last week and told you about, called Kind People, I believe it is. It showed how ridiculous the whole thing was down there in eastern Ukraine. All this historical reality, if understood by the American people, would put the Ukrainian crisis in a very different context. It has been effectively blacked out what the American public is allowed to hear. All the mainstream media talks about is Russian aggression. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Whenever they talk about us. Terror, right-wing terrorists. and how Putin provoked the Ukraine crisis as part of some Hitlerian plan to conquer Europe. Trump, in his bumbling way, tries to reference the real history to explain his contrarian views regarding Russia, Ukraine, and NATO, but he is confronted by a solid wall of groupthink asserting only one acceptable way to see this complex issue. Rather than allow a serious debate on these very serious issues, the mainstream U.S. media simply laughs at Trump's supposed ignorance, just like they do us, everything we say. The grave danger from this media behavior is that it will empower the neocons and liberal hawks already nesting inside Hillary Clinton's campaign to prepare for a new series of geopolitical provocations once Clinton takes office. By opportunistically buying into this neocon pro-war narrative now, Democrats may find themselves with buyer's remorse as they become the war party of 2017. Now, this was written by investigative reporter Robert Perry, who I have a lot of confidence in. Many of the Iran-Contra stories for the Associated Press and Newsweek in the 80s, he wrote. You can buy his latest book, American Stolen Narrative, either in print here or as an e-book from Amazon or Barnes & Noble. So anyhow, he hasn't joined our particular end of the struggle, but he does tell a lot of truth, and that's where you got to look for it. You can't look at David Duke's right-wing stuff. I mean, not that he doesn't tell the truth all the time. He tells the truth some of the time. But with him, it's simply the Jews. It's the Jews. Everything's the Jews. The weather changes, the Jews. Well, Jews are guilty of a lot of crimes, but right now we got a hell of a lot more problem with Islam. Behind the scenes, there is problems with the Jews, but, you know, I get sick and tired of these guys that spend all the time on the Jews when you got millions of Islamics that need to be suppressed, like China. Get rid of those Islamics. And also these warmongers in Washington, D.C. and New York City. Right. Anyhow, I'd advise you to check in on this consortiumnews.com from time to time, because there is some good stuff in there. Some of the stuff I don't agree much with, but there's a lot of stuff in there that, a lot of articles that are damn good about what's really going on. Well, they're going out to the professors again. Usually not, but this time they do. Oberlin College, I don't know where that's at, has placed Professor Joy Kariga on paid leave pending an investigation into anti-Semitic statements she made on social media. The college said in a statement today she will not teach at Oberlin this coming fall semester. Kariga attained notoriety over last year when her anti-Jewish Facebook posting came to light. That's terrible, free speech. Facebook doesn't allow free speech anymore. Among other assertions, Kariga dubbed ISIS a CIA and Mossad operation. Probably true. Posted a video asserting that Israel perpetrated 9/11, claiming the Jewish state downed Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 and said the Mossad perpetuated the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and shared an anti-Semitic meme of Jewish banker Jacob Rothschild that declared, quote, "We own your news, the media, your oil, and your governments," unquote. Well, remember the time when they, wasn't Netanyahu, but one of them said that we'll take care of the Congress. We control the Congress and the Senate. You see, you can't tell the truth with Jews. You can't tell the truth. Oberlin's move to suspend Kariga from teaching marks the first concrete step taken by its administration towards addressing Kariga's bigotry. Bigotry. You got to understand that telling the truth is bigotry. I thought bigotry was a big tree over in Italy. As Tablet reported, this is a Jewish outfit, after the college was informed about the professor's free speech outburst in January by alumni, it remained silent for a month until the media reported on Kariga's postings and forced the issue. Whoa! Moreover, this Jewish rag and other outlets have documented that Kariga's conduct reflects a broader climate of anti-Semitism at Oberlin College that has gone unaddressed for years. Notably, Kariga was hired to teach social justice writing, I think she's black, to undergraduates by a small search committee. They included two of Oberlin's associate deans, all of whom failed to recognize her free speech. Whether Kariga will serve as a scapegoat for Oberlin's institutional problems when it comes to Jews, or whether she will be the catalyst for a broader reckoning on anti-Semitism remains to be seen. The college full statement on Kariga is printed below. Well, let's see what it says. For the past several months, Oberlin College has been considering carefully the grave, grave issues surrounding the free speech postings on social media by Oberlin faculty member Dr. Joy Kariga. In March, in consultation with the president Marvin Krislav, who's probably a Jew too, the trustees of Oberlin College asked the administration and faculty to challenge the assertion that there's any justification for these repugnant free speech postings. The college initiated its faculty governance process to review Dr. Kariga's professional fitness in light of these postings. The faculty governance process that began thereafter is ongoing. We're checking that black bitch out, man. And the Oberlin administration will continue to respect this process as it plays out. Until that process is complete, Dr. Kariga has been placed on paid leave and will not teach at Oberlin because she wants too much free speech, and we can't have too much free speech. In recognition of the sensitivity of this review process and the privacy of the individuals involved, we will have no other comment until the conclusion of the process. In other words, the cover-up, the whitewash, and the whole bit. They claim that Oberlin College has had a lot of this free speech that they got to do something about. And this Jew rag is going to set out to do it. So if you think in any way that free speech is free, somebody said something to me this morning on the internet, and I said, no, freedom of speech is not free. Freedom of speech is very expensive. Crime in Chicago, Illinois. I'm shocked. City Hall, the head of the Chicago Police Union, blames additional paperwork in large part for the city's spike in shootings and the murders this year. Well, yeah, they have to go on and on filling out these forms proving they're not racist. They claim the American Civil Liberties Union immediately branded as irresponsible. Well, if they're spending all their time filling out papers, how are they going to do proper police work? I do believe that, said Dean Angelo Sr., president of the local Fraternal Order of Police. And I've been kind of criticized for saying that. Well,
For DNA Info Radio, I'm Matt Bubala, joined by our City Hall reporter, Ted Cox, talking about, this is very interesting, Ted, that, you know, we talk so much about the spike in crime and what's going on with the police and how they're handling things and what can be done. And now I was very surprised, the president of the local Fraternal Order of Police, Dean Angelo Sr., said that part of the problem is they have too much paperwork to do. Is that accurate? Is that what he's saying?
Well, we've done stories on this already earlier this year. Conkle did a series of them. And, yeah, I mean, like, what he's saying is that they used to have these contact cards. Every time a police officer had a contact with someone on the street, they had to do a contact card. And that was a little checklist that they had. And that has been replaced by what's been called an investigative Anyway, these investigative reports that that they have to do, and that's two full pages of explaining who they talked with, what they talked about. And he says, you do the math, you're dealing with 400 pages of paper by the end of the week.
And that's interesting. So and you talked to the ACLU for this article as well, because a lot of this, I believe, stems from this switch from these contact cards to this two-page questionnaire. Was a year where there were like 250,000 people stopped that weren't actually arrested, right? Just stopped,
right,
that police were making. And
in the
police,
summer of 2014, yes.
Okay, and so the police would argue, hey, we're checking in on the corners, we're talking to people, we're out and about and stopping people and chatting with them, keeping them from just congregating, things like that. There were some rulings that, this is illegal, that, you could just harass people, and so they didn't want that. But now the police are saying, but now look at how far we've gone this other direction. Now it's so much paperwork that it's preventing cops from having as much contact, because unless you're called to a scene, do you want to go there and talk to somebody and then spend 20 minutes filling out this paperwork?
Mm-hmm. Well, stops are down. Nobody counters that. But what the ACLU says is, first of all, that the police didn't like the contact cards in the first place. So, of course, they're not going to act like something additional that they're doing. And also they're saying that even though stops might be down, gun confiscations are up. So the ACLU maintains that the system is working.
Well, anybody could – I'm sure on the other side they could say, yeah, gun seizures are up, so are shootings, so are murders. So maybe that's not helping everything that we have those up, because there's still people on the street shooting each other, and more guns seem to be readily available no matter how many we seize, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The police department can complain as much as they want about this, but the odds are that things are going to get worse before they get better, depending on when the Department of Justice releases its report that it initiated after the Laquan McDonald video was released.
Is the police department taking the stance that the shootings are up because we have less contact, because of this paper, partially at least, because of the paperwork bogging them down and preventing them from getting as much contact with the citizenry as they were getting before?
They've acknowledged that stops are down, but they have not made that leap to say, hey, because we're not stopping people, that's why murders are up. They have not done that.
They could make the argument as well, though. It's interesting that, there's only so many hours in the day for the police, and the more time they spend filling out paperwork for a seeming non-event, the more time they're not out, in the street finding out what's going on or chasing down bad guys, right?
That's exactly what Angela was arguing.
And the ACLU, while they said, they don't like the contact cards either, so they can't argue this, do they have a defense on, do we know, Ted, how this compromise was made, that they moved from contact cards to these two-page questionnaires? Was that a direct, we'll slow the cops down from stopping so many people, or what was the reason they moved to the more full-length questionnaire?
Right. It stems from that summer where they please stop 250,000 people without any arrests or anything along those lines. ACLU has charged, and other people have charged, that those arrests that those stops were biased. If you look at the racial makeup of those are biased. And so these reports that came out of this was an agreement between the ACLU and the police department on that. And the ACLU maintains that the police brass, they like the new system, that they, give them more say over, they can have more scrutiny about who's where, what officers are doing what on a daily basis.
Fraternal Order Police, are they considered brass, or is that more police representative and not upper management?
No, you're talking about your district commanders, your supervisors, that sort of thing. Hmm.
Interesting. Have any of them commented that, yes, they do like the new system, or is that just anecdotal that the ACLU is saying they like it?
I think that I believe that Superintendent Johnson has defended it. I have to look up in our archives. I'm sure it's there somewhere. But, yeah, I think that's the case. They're certainly not – they have not fought that, the new report system.
Not as of yet, at least, for sure. Okay, well, the statistics keep piling up, and not in a good way, but there's another piece of the puzzle that we'll probably keep talking about. Our Ted Cox covering it for City Hall for
So I wonder how many people were murdered, both white and black or whatever, while these cops are filling out these two pages. Every time there's a little stop with somebody on the street, they're filling out two pages of crap for the ACLU. And we know about the ACLU. When we need them, we never get them. when the other side wants them, they get them all over the place. That's the ACLU. So, the more cops are bogged down writing up these reports, expect more murders in Chicago. That's it for now. I'll be back tomorrow on Freya's Day, and in the meantime, have a good white day. Think white, act white, be white. Yeah. Let's give a hat off to the Chinese for outlawing Islam. I like that.
He says the 126 texts that he studied were all written in the period during or soon after the supposed existence of Jesus of Nazareth. And Polkovich, the historian, says that had this man existed, somebody surely would have heard of him or written something. You know, somebody as famous as Jesus, but there's no mention. Polkovich said, he writes in his synopsis of his research, he writes, quote, "When I considered those 126 writers, all of whom should have heard of Jesus but did not, and Paul and Marcion and Athenagoras and Matthew with a tetralogy of opposing Christs, the silence from Qumran and Nazareth and Bethlehem, conflicting Bible stories, and so many other mysteries and omissions, I must conclude that Jesus is a mythical character," end quote. He goes on to say that Jesus of Nazareth was nothing more than an urban or desert legend, like an agglomeration of several evangelic and deluded rabbis who might have existed at the time. Of the writings that he examined, written from the first to third centuries, he found only one book that contained a mention of Jesus, and that was The Jewish Wars. That was a title by Roman historian Josephus Flavius. And that writer claims the whole story of Jesus was completely fabricated. We'll be right back. Is claiming that Jesus of Nazareth was a mythical character and never existed, which, you know, would make sense. It doesn't diminish, I don't think, the what has been credited as being the words of this humanist philosopher rabbi from 2,000 years ago, but that's a whole different story. Polkovich, the researcher, says even in the Bible, Paul, who is often credited with spreading what would become Christianity, Paul, who wrote all his letters to the various populations in Syria and Turkey during that time, that Paul never refers to Jesus as a real person. Polkovich writes, quote, "Paul is unaware of the Virgin Mother. He's ignorant of Jesus's nativity, his parentage, his life events, his ministry, his miracles, his apostles, his betrayal, his trial, and his harrowing passion. Paul knows neither where nor when Jesus lived, and considers the crucifixion metaphorical," end quote. Well, that's true. If you read Paul's letters to the Thessalonians, or Paul's letters to the Romans, or all the different books in the New Testament where Paul is writing to spread Christianity, you find that that's true. Polkovich also says that that silence from the Jesus character himself is telling, with no personal accounts being written. Polkovich says, quote, "Perhaps the most bewildering silent one is the mythical super-savior himself, Jesus, the Son of God, ostensibly sent on a suicide mission to save us from the childish notion of Adam's transgression, as we learn from Romans, the book of Romans." He adds, "The Jesus character is a phantom of a wisp of a personage who never wrote anything." So add one more to Polkovich's list of writers who never mentioned Jesus, and that would be Jesus himself. He goes on, Polkovich, he writes, "Christian Father Marcion of Pontus in 144 CE denied any virgin birth or childhood for the Jesus infant. He says the circumcision of Jesus was a lie, as well as the crucifixion. And this was a Christian person, I guess. I guess that's what Michael Polkovich is writing here. He goes on to say, reading the works of second century Christian Father Athenagoras, one never encounters the word Jesus. Athenagoras was thus unacquainted with the name of his Savior, it would seem. End quote. Polkovich also claims even the book of Mark in the Bible, which contains the story of Jesus' resurrection, was doctored later after Mark wrote it. Polkovich says the original booklet, given the name Mark, ended at chapter 16, verse 8, and later forgers added the fanciful resurrection tale. He adds, millions have heard of the Jesus crucifixion with its astral enchantments, zombie armies, and meteorological marvels recorded not by any historian, but only in the dubitable scriptures scribbled decades later by superstitious yokels. Woo! Anyway, this guy, Michael Polkovich, his views surely will prove very controversial, it says here in the Mail Online, as most scholars do not support the theory that Jesus never existed. Most agree that he was a Galilean Jew born between 7 to 4 B.C., and who died in 30 to 36 A.D. It is also widely agreed that he was baptized by John the Baptist and crucified on the order of the Roman prefect Pontius Pilate. Now, can you imagine the condemnation that this historian, Michael Polkovich, is getting as a result of what he considers to be his research? And if you go to the Mail Online, you can see the list of writers from that time. He lists them all, who never mentions Jesus of Nazareth or uses the celestial title Christ. It's just not there. And again, you take it for what it's worth, but Polkovich makes a point. If there was somebody wandering around, some rabbi wandering around the Middle East 2,000 years ago, raising people from the dead and walking on the water and multiplying food for thousands of people sitting by the Sea of Galilee, and who miraculously rises from the dead and so on and so forth, surely, somebody would have written about it. There had to have been an equivalent of a Wolf Blitzer all those years ago. Texts that he studied were all written in the period during or soon after the supposed existence of Jesus of Nazareth. And Polkovich, the historian, says that had this man existed, somebody surely would have heard of him or written something, somebody as famous as Jesus, but there's no mention.